Want to break into the theater? Well, Nick Offerman has some career advice.
I say just pick a place you like and show up and sweep whenever you can. And it's a farming gesture. People are like, oh, that's a good-willed person with a work ethic. Can you memorize lines?
The Parks and Rec actor has a new stand-up comedy show. Nick Offerman is on the Frame Weekend. And This Close is a TV show created by and starring two deaf people, Shoshana Stern and Josh Feldman.
Typically, deaf characters are these amazing people or their role models.
There are all kinds of deaf people in the world. Deaf people can fools too.
Plus, the L.A. band La Santa Cecilia on the power of music and the perils of social media. It's the Frame Weekend at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. This is the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. Later today, how the costume designer for The Handmaid's Tale feels about that iconic red cape and white bonnet becoming a protest uniform for women's reproductive rights. But we'll start with the multi-talented Nick Offerman.
I never dreamed that I would get to tour with just a backpack and a guitar and show up to theaters around the world and give the audience a piece of my mind and sing some dumb, funny songs that I wrote. And they'll pay me and call that a job.
The actor, whose career was solidified on Parks and Rec, shows no signs of slowing down. In addition to his acting work, he's the author of several books, including Paddle Your Own Canoe. He's an expert woodworker running the Offerman Woodshop out of an East L.A. studio, and he's currently touring a new live show, which he calls All Rise.
My goal with the show is, and with the title All Rise, is to point out things about really me. It's looking at a mirror and saying, okay, what tribal behaviors, what sort of ruts are we in as a society that are partly at the root of these problems that I can make fun of? And by doing so, maybe help us all step up a little bit. In the show, I say, I believe that, if you boil down the Constitution, purportedly the point of America is to be cool to everybody. And, you can feel us just slowly like clawing our way
toward that
to
or
that
away from that
eventual goal.
The thing that's also interesting about the tour is where you're playing. A couple weeks ago, you were at the Windstar World Casino and Resort in Thackerville, Oklahoma. I think in a couple of days, you're at the Fox Cities PAC, whatever that is, Performing Arts Center.
That's right.
In Appleton, Wisconsin. Are you intentionally not being a coastal tour where you're just playing New York, L.A., San Francisco, to actually play the entire country? And does the show play differently in different parts of the country?
It's interesting. There's a small percentage of the fan base that didn't understand that Parks and Rec was a comedy, perhaps, or fictional. And so there are people out there who consider Ron Swanson to be a real life, like, libertarian hero, and they come expecting like a treatise on the double barrel shotgun or something. And so they, some of them come around to good humor. Some of them probably leave in a huff. but by and large, I think I've had enough exposure that people have a pretty good idea what they're getting. At the heart of Parks and Rec, and hopefully at the heart of my material, is a good-natured ribbing about how people are complicated. And I try not to insult people, but I do definitely, I'm very judgmental of foolish actions, I would shake anybody's hand and offer them a sandwich if they came to my house, but if they happened to put kids in cages or something, I'd say, let's talk about this real quick. That's maybe not the coolest thing.
By the way, and I know that sounds weird, apparently this is not the first time you've been to KPCC, according to your wife, at least. She may be an unreliable narrator, but I'm going to play something she said when she was here not long ago.
Okay.
Yeah. Crazy.
Is he here? Can we talk about him?
Yeah, he's out in the car. Oh, shoot. Did I leave the windows open now? Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Somebody check.
You've been waiting a lot all this time, many months, but yeah. The windows were open. You had some food and some water.
I mean, that's the story of my career. I sat in the parking lot of NBC for 10 years, and then finally somebody asked me to come in and sweep, and somebody else thought that my mustache was funny, and here we are.
So just be present, show up, and hope good things happen?
You know what? That's actually advice that I give young people that say they want to get into really any business, but specifically theater. I say just pick a place you like and show up and try and sweep whenever you can. It's a farming gesture where people are like, oh, that's a good-willed person with a work ethic. Can you memorize lines?
It's funny you say that because I was a theater major in college, and I thought I wanted to direct plays. So I did want to direct plays, and I ended up going to some local theater companies, and they gave me a broom. And I said, I cannot do this for 2 years. I cannot sweep floors for 2 years. So here I am. But you kept sweeping, right?
I did, yeah. And even in my wood shop these days, when a position opens up and we're looking for somebody new, we ask them to sweep because, and here's the advice part. If you ever get the chance to do that, sweep like you're a surgeon. Like, move every couch, sweep every possible inch. That's the question. Will you impress me with how meticulous you sweep?
We're talking with actor, writer, comedian, musician, and woodworker Nick Offerman. I'm curious about creative decisions, creative choices you make. You're doing something with Noah Hawley, Lucy in the Sky. I think you're doing something coming up with Alice Garland. How do you decide what gets you motivated, what interests you, and how has that evolved over the last couple of years in terms of choosing things and saying no to other things?
Well, it's a great question. There was a time, I don't know, 15 years ago, I was Mr. Megan Mullally. I had my wood shop, and I was working semi-regularly as a character actor. And I had driven from Los Angeles to Santa Clarita, which is maybe 45 minutes north, and that's where you had to go if you had an audition for CSI. And I had been up there maybe 7 times to read for some version of the rapist or serial killer.
Without being cast.
That's right.
Okay.
And audition number 8 came in, and I said, you know what? I'm going to start to choose to say no to things. And it's incredible to just ever get a job in Hollywood in the first place. And so if things go well enough that you get to the point where you can pick things, and that continued, of course, Parks and Recreation upped my cachet, I mean, exponentially, to the point where when that ended, I suddenly was being offered huge sitcom lead contracts, but they were all about an ex-Marine who loves to grill or a football coach, you know, who's tough as nails. And I was like, yeah, that's the only thing I don't want to do is another mustache comedy. And so Megan and I have really always been this way, whether it's in the theater or in shooting for the camera. We don't go looking for a comedy or a genre. All we do is consider the writing that comes across our table and working with people that we think are good people. I'm really expecting something to come along for Megan, who is the greatest actress. I may be slightly biased, but she's known for her comedy chops, but her dramatic work is astonishing. And I'm just, you know, I'm expecting her to have a Bryan Cranston turn where somebody realizes she should be the lead of the next Fleabag or Breaking Bad.
Nick, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. It's not really partisan or even untrue to say that Donald Trump loves television. He tweets regularly about what he's watching, Fox News, not CNN. And he uses the language of TV currency, that is, ratings, to refer to his own success. But James Poniewozik, the chief TV critic for The New York Times, doesn't actually see Trump just as a fan of television. In many ways, Poniewozik writes that he's a construct of the medium. His new book is called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to talk about a TV reality show, not Apprentice, but a show called Survivor, and about the winner of the first year, Richard Hatch.
I don't think somebody's in control of our group in particular. I think I'm in control of who's being voted off. And I think that's all that matters to me.
God, I'm glad I'm on your team.
Yeah, baby.
You write of Hatch, he realized that the only rules were that there were no rules. He lied and backstabbed and took advantage of loopholes, and he argued with a telegenic brashness that this made him smart. So how do you draw the connection between Richard Hatch and Donald Trump, setting aside for a fact that The Apprentice and Survivor were both produced by Mark Burnett?
Richard Hatch's arc in winning the first season of Survivor is basically Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. You know, he won a vote by arguing to his audience that he was a bad guy maybe, but he deserved it. He outplayed them. He outlasted them. And even if you didn't like him, even if you didn't like his methods, you know, you had to admire how well he did it. And that was very much a part of Donald Trump's argument for himself at every debate.
Oh, you didn't delete him?
Allow her to respond, please.
Personal emails, not official.
33,000?
Well, we turned over 35,000, so it was.
What about the other 15,000?
Please allow her to respond. She didn't talk while you talked.
Yes, that's true. I didn't.
Because you have nothing to say.
In the first debate, and I'm going to try not to in this debate.
We are a culture now that is comfortable with the idea of rooting for the anti-hero, of rooting for this sort of charismatic breaker of norms who makes a compelling argument that, you know, you can kind of morally compartmentalize and say, yeah, okay, maybe I wouldn't want this guy as a model for my kids, but it's an ugly world full of ugly competition, and, you know, sometimes you got to break some eggs to win.
I want to play a clip now from The Apprentice.
The problem is that Bradford made a stupid, impulsive, life-threatening decision that, frankly, if you were running a company and made that kind of a decision, you destroy that company instantaneously. Bradford, you're fired.
The author and comedian Fran Lebowitz said of Trump that he is, quote, a poor person's idea of a rich person. And I'm wondering how that assessment falls into what happened in The Apprentice and how Trump was cast and depicted, because he wasn't necessarily the thing that the show presented him to be.
Fran Lebowitz's great quote might be meant as an insult, but it also explains why he was perfect for reality TV. Because what reality TV needs is not the thing itself. It needs the cartoon of the thing, right? You know, the Survivor is a shut-in's idea of survival in nature. The Bachelor is a lonely person's idea of romance. And on The Apprentice, when Mark Burnett is creating this show, he doesn't need a hugely successful businessman. He needs the symbol of a successful businessman. He needs the idea of business. And what Donald Trump had been doing for decades at that point was basically producing himself as a personal reality TV show. You know, in other words, he's surrounding himself with all of these signifiers of wealth and success, you know, a tower in Manhattan with his name on it in 3 feet tall brass letters, a jet and a helicopter with his name on it, all of these images of gold and luxury overload, all of these things getting into the popular media and the popular consciousness that, you know, when you just sort of close your eyes and imagine what is my picture of a rich guy, Donald Trump comes to mind.
Right. And he is depicted as incredibly successful at a time when he is teetering on bankruptcy.
Yeah. You know, one thing that happened with Donald Trump was that at the end of the 80s, his businesses crash and he runs into these bankruptcies. And literally, the sort of fictional character of Donald Trump has to bail out the real businessman, Donald Trump, because he has to keep his brand alive for his creditors and the people who took over his businesses and needed to keep a value in them. And that meant that he had to keep up the appearance. And he starts playing himself as this sort of self-parodic character who, you know, will go anywhere that there's a TV camera and does, you know, cameos on The Fresh Prince.
Ron said his client had a rich uncle, but Donald Trump.
I like keeping a low profile.
Whether or not the bottom line of his actual business is impressive doesn't matter if you can build an impressive appearance within the four walls of a TV studio.
We're talking with James Poniewozik about his book, Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. So if Donald Trump kind of creates himself as this TV character and he runs for president as this kind of hyper reality show, then what is the White House? How does that fit into the narrative of how television is the definition and the world in which Donald Trump exists?
He used television in many ways to get elected, but once he's president, TV in many ways controls him because he is not only a TV personality, he is a voracious TV consumer. You know, so now you're president and you're the star of this TV show that's on 24 hours a day. It's called The News, and the president is always the main character in it. You know, why would you ever watch anything else? And in fact, it often seems that that's the main thing that he does. And it drives his agenda. It drives the news agenda. It controls the world that we're living in because he's getting up in the morning and watching Fox and Friends or watching news shows on TiVo, getting mad about them, tweeting about them.
Donald Trump tweeted that he is ordering, he said, U.S. companies to find an alternative to doing business in China. He said,
progressive congresswomen critical of his immigration policies should go back to the countries they originally came from.
Okay, so he sent the Alabama tweet out saying Alabama was at risk along with Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina.
Cough of Fifi. Can you explain this one for us?
It creates this sort of feedback loop of just intensifying, constantly building conflict that is just basically the metabolism of the reality that we live now.
If Donald Trump is, in some ways, the Donald Trump show, like other TV series, if we all stopped watching and talking about it, would the Trump show featuring Donald Trump get canceled?
Well, you know, here is an interesting thing, because, you know, a big question right now is whether 3 years into Trump's presidency, you're seeing a kind of just exhaustion. Irrespective of people's individual politics, if, you know, people are just tired of, you know, constantly being agitated by what's coming across their phones or what's in the news and whether they want to break from it. Interestingly, one can see a bit of a parallel with this in the history of The Apprentice. The Apprentice was a huge sensation its first season on the air, and Donald Trump was its breakout star. And what NBC and The Apprentice and Donald Trump did is what you often do in television, which is if something is working, you milk it and you overexpose it and you give people five times as much of it, right? So they heavily scheduled The Apprentice and Donald Trump starts playing a more, you know, kind of in-your-face, exaggerated version of this you're fired guy character that he created on there. And people start to burn out on it. The ratings drop pretty quickly. And on the one hand, the show stays on the air for 14 seasons with Donald Trump. But on the other hand, it's never the number one thing on television again. Now, in television, you can, you know, lose your time slot to Mike and Molly and finish third, but still be profitable enough that you stay on the air. In an election, you finish third, you lost the election. So, you know, I do think that while getting a lot of attention has, you know, always been a lot of benefit to Donald Trump as a TV figure and a TV performance, he's also susceptible to the danger of overexposure and burnout.
James Poniewozik is the chief TV critic for The New York Times. His new book is Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. James, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, the creators of Game of Thrones. Their recap show was born from a love of talking about Game of Thrones in a hair salon, and now it's vying for a Creative Arts Emmy. That's next on The Frame Weekend. It's The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. Next weekend are the Primetime Emmys, but this weekend are the Creative Arts Emmys, and there are so many awards in the Creative Arts, the TV Academy is doing it over two nights. The categories run the gamut from behind-the-scenes jobs to awards for animation, reality, documentary, and short form or web series. Among the nominees for Best Short Form Variety Show is Game of Thrones.
Oh my God, Brian, did you watch the first episode of the final season of Game of Thrones?
You know, I see you once every 18 months for a haircut, and this always happens to me.
Buckle up, queen, because the wall is down, a woman's on the throne, it's the America I wish I was living in.
The Funny or Die series was co-created by Jonathan Van Ness and Aaron Gibson, and we visited them on set this year. It was essentially a closet outfitted to look like a hair salon. Aaron was directing the episode.
I'm as vindictive and unreasonable as any man.
Yes.
And Jonathan was on camera giving a fake haircut to Kumail Nanjiani while they dished about a recent episode of Game of Thrones.
I am just as vindictive and unreasonable as any man.
Great. Okay, good. We're going to cut and now we're going to reset. We have five-ish minutes.
The success of Game of Thrones helped Jonathan Van Ness get cast in Queer Eye, and that meant a lot of time in airplanes, especially when Game of Thrones was in production.
Season 7, which was the last season, I was in Atlanta shooting Queer Eye, so I would shoot Queer Eye Tuesday through Friday and then get on a plane and then come here, do Game of Thrones, get back on the plane, go back to Atlanta. And now this time, I have since moved to New York, and so Sunday mornings, I get up, and I pop on a plane, and I get here, and then I come watch a show with everyone, and then I pitch all my jokes before everyone else gets to pitch their jokes, which is really nice of me. So, you know, then everyone else gets to stay up till midnight, and then I tap out at 9. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so tired. Which I say is a joke, but really, I am. It's a lot. Like,
you have to go to sleep. We need you to be amazing on camera.
She does. You need to go to bed.
When you were thinking about how you were going to both recap an episode and then do something that's funny, how do you figure out what is first? Because is it important that you get the story right first and then add the jokes, or what order do they come in?
I think it's always about serving the purpose of how Jonathan has regurgitated the show. So in my mind, it's always funny first. But I do want this to be a cheat sheet for people who maybe don't watch Game of Thrones and maybe want to not feel like they're an outcast in society at work.
Aaron really, I think, is so smart and has really been the driving force behind crafting, like, what needs to be in Game of Thrones, like what's important to recap, like what storylines are going places and like what we can leave like for next time, and not even like what we can leave for next time, but what would be a bigger comedic payoff if we maybe didn't recap this scene with this particular storyline this week and hit it next week, like so that you let it build. So Aaron's really good about like figuring out like what needs to be in and what needs to be out to actually recap the show.
The other thing that you guys seem to be really intentional about is making sure that you have the most latest pop culture references possible. So you just did an episode where you have a Mayor Pete reference. There's a reference to the Boeing 737 Max. Is it always like what happened that day that we can incorporate? How do you think about what is and is not funny or worth including?
Well, I have to say, you know, but in the episode from last week, you know, it was all about Martina Hingis.
This battle had more ups and downs than Martina Hingis' storied tennis career?
So first, things are going great. She wins the Australian Open in 97.
Well, then she screws up the French Open by serving underhanded to Steffi Graf and gets booed off the court.
But then she goes on to slay at Wimbledon.
Unfortunately.
That's what I love about our writing room is that, like, we're going to get niche. We're going to go big. We're going to go niche. We're going to go now. We're going to go 86. We're going to go 94. You don't know. Also, we might have a Revolutionary War thing. Like, you just don't know what you're going to get.
We're talking with Jonathan Van Ness and Aaron Gibson about Game of Thrones. This all started in a barber's chair. Or do we call it a salon chair?
A salon chair.
Well, Jonathan's been doing my hair for almost 10 years. I met you in 2008.
No, because I moved here in 9.
Okay, so it must have been at 9, though.
I met you in the end of 9. By early 2010, I was like, what's the haps?
I was dyeing my own hair, and you were like, what are you doing?
Yep, there was a little situation going on when I took her back to the shampoo bowl to get her ready for my boss.
I can only have the money to get an expensive haircut. I don't have the money to dye my hair.
Well, I don't want to bust you out.
Thank you.
Use it.
I'll say.
Yeah. So then I was like, well, I'm making like $8 an hour, and I would love to do your hair at midnight after I'm done assisting if you would like to come over like once a month. So I would put her in my roommate's gigantic Cheetos t-shirt that was my like at-home smock.
We would watch 4 years.
Yeah, we really would. It was like, it took like 4 years. And then finally I got on the floor and I got into a salon and we were able to do her hair like in a salon like normal people.
And that's when this all happened because I was working at Funny or Die as a writer-director and I was at that point the only female on staff and I was in the chair with Jonathan. He was recapping Game of Thrones to another stylist client and he kept calling Robert Baratheon she. And I just thought, this is really funny. So I went into Funny or Die and I was like, hey, I have a off-the-wall pitch. Can I bring my hairdresser who's never been on camera in here to recap this show? And literally, this is the kind of place where they're just like, all right. So we did it.
Jonathan, how important has Game of Thrones been to you? Because you're still doing it, even though obviously since that first pitch, a lot has changed in your life.
When Erin said that, I thought she meant like on a phone. I had never really been like on a set, so I didn't understand like what we were really getting into. And then we have like, I mean, Erin and I have done this for 53 episodes together. Matt Mazzani, our executive producer, has been on this for 53 episodes. There are people that, you know, have been on this show. Our core people have been on the show together since 2013. So it's like, it's just so fun to do. And I feel like every other way that my life has changed, which I knew I wanted to do hair when I was like a 4-year-old kid. And I always just wanted to be a successful hairdresser who didn't need to borrow money from anyone to cover my rent and like just wanted to like breathe. And when I started making stuff on camera with Erin, I, you know, got bit by a severe case of that I want to keep making content bug. And my life has changed so much, but I would not have experienced like any of the changes that my life has experienced if it wasn't for my friendship with Erin and if it wasn't for her seeing a potential in me that I never knew that I had. So I wouldn't be where I am in any way if it wasn't for Game of Thrones. So there was no way I wasn't going to finish it out and come see my friends and get to make this, finish what we started, you know?
But it was so obvious from the minute you were talking in that chair to me, like, that you were meant to do this. Like, I wouldn't just put someone in a chair on camera if I didn't think that you had it in you to do it. You know what I mean? It wasn't like some like weird experiment where I was like, let's see if this is a failure. I was like, this is going to work because you're involved.
But that's why I say that she is like the usher to my Justin Bieber, because she really discovered me to me. Like, I didn't even know that I could do any of the things that I've done. And she was like the first person. I was like, oh, like that queen's got potential. I didn't know.
Jonathan and Erin, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
That was Jonathan Van Ness and Erin Gibson, the executive producers of Game of Thrones. It's nominated for a Creative Arts Emmy in the Short Form Variety category that'll be handed out tonight. I'm John Horn, and you're listening to The Frame Weekend. If you were in a bookstore this week, you saw on the new arrivals table, The Testaments. It's Margaret Atwood's long-awaited sequel to her 1985 book, The Handmaid's Tale. And thanks to the Hulu series, the Handmaid's costumes, red capes and white bonnets, have become a symbol for the repression of women's reproductive rights. The Frame's Julia Paskin talked with Natalie Bronfman, the costume designer for The Handmaid's Tale, and she talked about how the iconic costume became a protest uniform.
It's not every Emmy season the costume of a fictional television character becomes the symbol of a political movement.
Now, the guardians of the faithful and American soldiers still fight with tanks in the remains of Chicago. Now, Anchorage is the capital of what's left of the United States.
But the puritanical totalitarian nation of Gilead, created in Hulu's dramatic series The Handmaid's Tale, has struck a chord with some worried about women's rights in the real world. signifying a society laden with fanatical religious violence and the systematic dehumanization of women, homemade Handmaid's costumes have become a uniform for women's rights and pro-choice protests around the world.
Protesters evoking the Handmaid's Tale surrounding the state house.
Even at Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearing.
But beyond the headlines, season three costume designer Natalie Brontman brings reality to the show's characters, not with words, but by adjusting their clothing with careful nuance. She says in the most recent season of The Handmaid's Tale, the look for the steely Serena Joy Waterford, played by Yvonne Strahovski, is somewhat inspired by Grace Kelly and Jacqueline Kennedy. Serena's a generally cruel and stoic woman who begins the third season in an uncharacteristically vulnerable place.
The beautiful woman that is always immaculately put together. Not initially, her character changes quite a lot from being this mother to now battling with her own agency and becomes strong again.
I'm sorry.
You know there's no place in this world for you without Fred.
But eventually she becomes this ice queen, I want to say. Absolutely pristine and perfect.
I wrote my first book there.
You were a good writer.
How could you take that away from me?
I can change things a little bit and be very creative because her shapes change. And that's how I'm trying to show where she is in her mental state at the time by fabrics, shapes, softness, hardness.
The show's lead protagonist is a handmaid played by Elizabeth Moss, part of a designated class of virtual slaves subjected to a life of rape and forced pregnancies. Brontman says the vibrant crimson red of the handmaid's costume was initially meant to represent fertility.
What I've tried to do this season is take it from it being the defenseless handmaid, where they're always under the microscope, to flipping it into being angry and through that anger, finding the courage to get what they need.
You will never be free of me.
Hence the red works both sides.
You will never be free of me until both my children are safe.
Well, another thing is also that they're easily spotted and prevents them from running anywhere and hiding.
Hands up!
So in other words, that's a prison uniform, which actually this color was used as a prison uniform for POWs at one point so that they were easily spotted in the snow. Actually, everything that occurs in our show has at some point happened in time throughout history. And that's the scary part of it all, because it is very real. I don't think they are harsher or more drastic than any human has done to another human so far. It's been done.
Season 3 of The Handmaid's Tale features a Washington, D.C. conquered by the fictional nation of Gilead. Handmaids in the dystopian capital live in an even harsher reality. They wear thick cloth veils over their mouths, later revealed to cover metal rings piercing their lips shut. It's a startling sight that even shocks the brutal character of Aunt Lydia, known for her torturous stewardship of the handmaids.
Do you want us all to be silenced?
No. No, I don't.
The veiling I chose for the handmaids covered basically the only remaining thing that was visible on them in terms of flesh. And when they're outside, this particular veil would sit under their noses because it also still allows for a lot of expression. Often when someone's angry, you can tell because their nostrils are flaring, or if you're anxious, or even if you're smiling, you can see the expression in just the nose. So that would be the last thing we could see.
Blessed are the silent, for only they will hear the voice of the Lord. Head down, please.
On the back of their necks, they're closed with fur hooks, which have an extra clasp that locks, which sort of is a little odd looking because the fabric itself is not that heavy duty. So there's that dichotomy of materials.
In the real world, protest groups don simple, homemade versions of the red and white bonnet as a symbol of women's reproductive rights. And the show's cast has leaned into the image, too, releasing a PSA in support of Planned Parenthood. Here's series star Elizabeth Moss.
When we start restricting access to abortion, our country takes one step closer to Gilead.
Brontman said she's glad the costume can be a symbol of resistance and also a harbinger for a potentially problematic future.
I am getting either emails or through Instagram small messages from women all around the world. I am just glad that it is being used for this, and I am glad that it is trying to shake the people awake. A preemptive, this is what could happen, if you're not careful, if you're not paying attention.
For The Frame, I'm Julia Paskin.
Natalie Broffman was formerly the costume supervisor on The Handmaid's Tale. Season 2 designer Anne Crabtree, Broffman, and their team are nominated for a 2019 Emmy Award. Coming up...
To be able to be there and provide some upliftment and some, you know, a voice for the community and to be a part of an event with so many amazing and inspiring activists was just a beautiful experience.
Members from the LA band La Santa Cecilia share music from their new album, and they talk about playing a show in El Paso following the mass shooting there at a Walmart. It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The Grammy-winning quartet La Santa Cecilia has a new album, and it's simply titled La Santa Cecilia.
Dream, my sweet dream, you come to me like the sunrise. Dream.
As far as I know, there is no patron saint for radio hosts, but there is a patron saint for musicians. What is her name?
La Santa Cecilia.
Saint yeah. Cecilia. And I guess that's... I spoke with singer Mari Sol Hernandez and percussionist Miguel Oso Ramirez. They were just back from performing in El Paso following the mass shooting at a Walmart there last month.
Like many people, I think we all felt very impotent, and we all feel very impotent at the sight of these occurrences and these massacres. And to be able to be there and provide some upliftment and some, you know, a voice for the community and to be a part of an event with so many amazing and inspiring activists was just a beautiful experience.
You also did something outside a detention center, is that right?
Yeah, we went outside of one of the detention centers and we brought them some music. You know, we came to sing some songs to the people that are detained, who are there for,
processing,
I mean, being processed and with no actual date or anything, just in captivity, no? And in jail. And so we just wanted to go and show our support to them. And I'm not sure if they heard us. I hope they did. I tried to sing as loud as I could. But just to, I mean, even just to bring some positive energy, you know what I mean, to the place. My best way of showing my love and support, you know, to my community, to my brothers and sisters, is to go there, to sing to them, to share in a moment, no?
Your new album is called La Santa Cecilia, and like a lot of your music, there are many influences that you can hear in any given song. I want to listen to a little bit of your rendition of Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out.
But if I ever get on my feet again,
a jazz group called the California Feet Warmers that you play with. Tell us about that collaboration and what you look for in musical partners and how, given all the influences you guys are juggling and inspired by, how you come up with a sound where it all comes together and things aren't fighting against each other.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, that came along, I think, more so through friendship more than anything. You know, we all hang out and drink and tell stories, and most of the time towards the end of the night, we end up playing music together. And, you know, the first time Marisol sang with them, and it's just like, it's magical because we all just love and admire one another so much. And again, it's an LA thing, man. Like, it happened here in LA. We're playing New Orleans jazz. We're doing these things that come together in a city where only it can come together here, you know, in LA. And it's very unique. But it's brotherhood, man. It's how we hang out. It's our good times, you know. It's our good times. It's how we live music and live friendship.
We're talking with Marisol Hernandez and Miguel Oso Ramirez from La Santa Cecilia. I want to play another song from your new record. This one is called Winning.
Hashtag thoughts and prayers. Can your soul be saved? Mimis, pine cone in the yard. So ready for this album to come out. Happy Year of the Pig from Young Me.
It feels like a song about Twitter, Instagram, Snap, but it's also about, I think, how you judge yourself. I want to ask you about how this song came together and what you guys were talking about and thinking about when you wrote it.
I mean, I think this is our way of at least my way of saying, like, how we are so addicted, man, to social media, you know, like, and how distracting it can be and how superficial.
Wait, hold that thought. I gotta check my Instagram feed. Okay, keep going.
Hold on, me too. I want to check my treats. I mean, I feel like we can barely pay attention, and I'm speaking for myself, man, you know how hard it is to focus sometimes when you're thinking about this thing, you know, this phone, this platform, and how much it's a part of our life and of our work too, you know, being in a band and having to use social media as a platform, right? So
yeah, connected and disconnected.
Yeah.
You guys have written songs that are really tied to the debate over immigration, and that's something that's real for you, because I think you have an accordion player who's a dreamer, mm-hmm. and I think you had to do things when you're on the road to make sure that you didn't get in trouble. So when you're thinking about how you're telling that story and about how it relates to you and your band, it becomes incredibly personal too, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a song that we wrote as, you know, as a response to what we were living, but you don't realize growing up was such a part of our life, you know, for in our case being Mexican immigrants or Mexican Americans, and having that experience within the band, knowing that our bandmate couldn't travel with us when we started traveling and leaving the country. Even going to Texas, we used to have to take the I-40 instead of the 10 because you have to cross a big immigration point past El Paso. I remember calling a friend whose dad was an immigration officer and asking her to ask, you know, like, what's the best route? And he told me to go that way. And it was something that we did because we wanted to pursue our dream. We wanted to follow our dream, but it was a very real thing that we were living in. When we did write the song El Hielo, which is about the separation of families and the whole dynamic of what happens when someone gets deported, it was a huge release valve, and so many emotions came out. And man, we were, you know, in D.C. playing in front of 150,000 people at huge rallies, and the song just meant so much to so many people, and that really changed our lives, really.
Uno se queda aquí, otro se queda allá. Eso pasa por salir a trabajar.
It was a big decision to put that song out because we knew that we would become very politicized as a band, and we would be looked at as a political band instead of just artists who make music. And that's not fair to artists sometimes, you know, but we thought that it was really important to do it. Like, this album, La Santa Cecilia, the self-titled album, this new album is about so many different things, not just that. It's about heartache and loss, and we went through a lot of things, and there's a lot of pain, and there's a lot of sweetness and love and togetherness on the album. And it's not necessarily that heavy on the political side, but, you know, as an artist, I think the main thing is just to be able to be honest with what you're living in the moment. And if it's telling a political message, or if it's talking about love or loss, then that's what you talk about.
Marisol Hernandez and Miguel Oso Ramirez are from the band La Santa Cecilia. Their new record is called La Santa Cecilia. Marisol and Miguel, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks. I've been thinking about you. I've been thinking about you and me.
This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn.
All that we share, from our first kiss to our last embrace, I've been drinking.
This Close is a dramedy on the Sundance Channel. It's about two best friends navigating love and life in Los Angeles. And on paper, that sounds pretty generic. But the show is actually anything but. It's the first of its kind, a TV series starring, created, and written by people who are deaf. Josh Feldman and Shoshana Stern are the creators and leads of This Close, and the Frame contributor Ari Saperstein has their story.
If there's one thing Shoshana Stern and Josh Feldman want viewers to take away from watching their show, it's this.
There are all kinds of deaf people in the world. Deaf people can be assholes too.
Typically, deaf characters are these amazing people or they're role models. And, you know, with our show, we really want to make sure that Kate and Michael would not be mistaken as role models. Like, they're just two normal young adults just trying to do their best.
I first meet Stern and Feldman when they're doing a photo shoot for the LA Times ahead of the season two premiere of This Close. They've come so far. In just a few short years, they went from a low-budget web series to a critically acclaimed show on the Sundance Channel. Working with a photographer who doesn't know sign language proves no problem at all, in part because Feldman and Stern have interpreters who translate for them. In fact, those are the voices you're hearing throughout this interview. The interpreters are hired by the studio, but Stern says other employers have not been willing to do the same.
People feel like, why do we have to shoulder that burden? Why don't you just bring someone with you who can interpret for you? That's what I often get. You know, I would love to, but that means that then I have to ask my friends for a favor, or then I have to pay out of my own pocket as well. I know it's not my responsibility as a deaf person to have to provide accessibility for them. At the same time, I also know that they can't see the value in providing accessibility for me yet. So I'm hoping by us hiring deaf people that people can see the value in it.
That includes, you know, casting people for in front of the camera work, hiring people to work behind the camera as well. How many deaf people did we have working altogether, did you say?
Around 25.
Yeah, about 25 people. So that included actors, photographers, hair and makeup people, editors.
Art department.
We've set a lot of new precedences with our show.
One of those precedents is Feldman and Stern's commitment to depicting authentic experiences of deaf people on screen. And not just visually, but also through sound.
I think most hearing people assume for deaf people that sound is binary and that it's an all or nothing kind of relationship. So with our show, the different kinds of deaf people that we have on screen and their different relationships with sound is definitely fun to portray. And it's fun to think about.
The sound design in This Close shows the spectrum of deafness. One standout scene features a group of both hearing and deaf characters having a conversation.
We had Millie, who has a cochlear implant in real life, and her character also was written to have a cochlear implant. We enter into this character sound perspective.
Blythe, this Russian tea is just too good. It's a holiday staple in there.
And then we had Kate, and she has to be dependent on her hearing aids.
Oh, did I tell you that the
And then Kate's granny, who was losing her hearing.
She's fine, but when she hit that kitchen floor, you would have
thought that the Lord was returning.
You know, sitting with a sound guy, I had to explain what that would really sound like to really show how different it is for each of these three women. Going into the sound booth for that and providing notes on sound. As a deaf person, I never thought that I would be giving notes on what the sound is.
As a show that frequently uses two languages, English and American Sign Language, the creators want to ensure that it's accessible to all audiences at all times.
Every time our characters sign, there will be subtitles on the screen. And when the characters speak, you'll have closed captioning. So nobody's going to miss out on anything. And that was really important to us as deaf people because oftentimes we miss out on things, whether it be just like the captioning goes haywire or the show is not closed captioned to begin with. You know, we've all experienced that as deaf people. So like we wanted to be very careful to make sure that our show was 100% accessible.
Even coming up with the title, This Close, was a process of bridging the divide between the hearing world of the network and the deaf world of the show.
We've gone back and forth with the network, back and forth. And all of it was like English words that they were trying to use to capture the deaf experience, like the sound of silence. Deaf like me. But I said, I think we're actually working backwards. I said, I really think that instead of trying to find an English word to capture the deaf experience, we should be thinking of a sign. because that's the language of the community that we're trying to portray. So we should think of a sign and then find a translation into English from the sign.
And with that, Shoshana held up her hand to show me the sign for this close.
So you would have your index finger and your middle finger crossing. So we're showing that something that's intertwined by having our fingers literally intertwined. And so that's also a sign used for best friends.
The show is about growing up. And so you often feel this close to something, but you're not quite there yet.
Now, this is Feldman and Stern's first time on the radio. So I decided to end the interview by asking them about the elephant in the room. Does it feel weird to participate in something that isn't very accessible to deaf people?
Well, in a way, it's a little weird, right? Because we would never really know what the final product actually sounds like. So yes, it is a little strange. But as long as we get more people to listen to our story, then so be it.
Shoshana Stern and Josh Feldman are the stars and creators of the Sundance TV show This Close. Special thanks to interpreters Robbie Sutton and Samantha Garley. For The Frame, I'm Ari Saperstein.
This Close airs Thursday on the Sundance Channel, or you can stream it on Sundance Now. And that is a wrap for us. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by her and Jonathan Shiflett, Robert Garova, and Julia Paskin. Valentino Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. The Frame's theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday with the daily version of The Frame. We'll be right back.